Welcome back to Books, Films, Tilly. This is your host, Tilly, and today I'll be discussing the 2022 adaptation of the book Lady Chatterley's Lover, originally written by D.H. Lawrence. First of all, I hope you're having a good day. For those of you who know me, they know that this is long overdue, and I'm basically here getting this book and this film off my chest. So this one is dedicated to those of you who've already listened to the equivalent of this episode in audio messages and rants, all because of this book. I have in front of me a 19-page long document with no repetition in my notes, and I can only say 7 pages of it max, and then 10% at least will be cut out. I cannot fit everything I want to say into this episode, and to be honest, like, that's part of the reason why it's taking me so long to do this. I started reading this book at the end of November because I wanted to finish it before watching the movie, which came out on the 2nd of December, I believe. And I can comfortably say I'm a quick reader. It took me until January to drag my way through it, with other books being read in the meantime to kind of cleanse the palate. So yeah, there's my personal little introduction as to how I feel about this book and how this episode is gonna be. Okay, so the Penguin Classic version of this book's blurb goes as such. Lady Constance Chatterley feels trapped in her sexless marriage to the Sir Clifford. Paralysed in the First World War, Sir Clifford is unable to fulfil his wife emotionally or physically, and encourages her instead to have a liaison with a man of their own class. But Connie is attracted instead to Oliver Mellors, her husband's gamekeeper, with whom she embarks on a passionate affair that brings new life to her stifled existence. Can she find true love with Mellors, despite the vast gulf between their positions in society? And then, this is not part of like the description of the book, but it says, one of the most controversial novels in English literature, Lady Chatterley's Lover is an erotically charged and psychologically powerful depiction of adult relationships. Okay, so straight away I need to add some additional context. Clifford's family owns mines. That's how they've built a lot of their wealth, with Tevershall being his mine's village. If you don't know what that means, it's a village where primarily all those who worked in the mine lived. You have in England, you have these, and across the UK, and they exist in other countries as well, but in the UK you have old mining villages. And they're where all of the people who worked in the mine lived. So basically they're these entire villages that depend on the success of the mine and the wealth it produces. And therefore, you know, they depend on the people who are running the mines. And then a second piece of context, the actual reason why Clifford encourages her to have an affair with someone of their own class is because they need an heir for Rugby, which is the estate that Sir Clifford owns and where they stay at. He needs an heir for the Chatterley line. It's not, you know, he doesn't say go have an affair with another man out of kindness or an acknowledgement of how he's neglected her. It's because they need an heir. Because all of his brothers died in the war. He's the last one of his line, basically. This book is set in the interwar period and was first published in 1928 in Italy, then a year later in France, and an uncensored edition was only published in England in 1960 after Penguin Books Limited won against the state during a trial conducted due to the Obscene Publications Act of 1959, which Penguin obviously won. They obviously won the trial. And it was censored due to its very explicit sexual content. D.H. Lawrence died in 1930. Therefore, this is probably one of the best fictional testimonies of the interwar period due to its unintentional detachment from what would happen later. It has no foresight. It could not have been altered by D.H. Lawrence to offer that as well. And it's also interesting because obviously it's offering a point of view that is not even affected by the Great Depression. Very, very, very interesting text alone. So was the film better than the book? There's a difference between what I liked and what I would recommend. However, my verdict is made more difficult by the fact that I disliked both the book and the film. If you want a classic, if you want something that's uncomfortably true to its era, read Lady Chatterley's Lover. 20 pages in, I was already thinking, this is a classic. The insight it gives us on an intellectual's, aka D.H. Lawrence's, perception of society at this turning point in the world, but also Britain, which is a crumbling world superpower at the time, is priceless. It did, however, make me feel sick. And that sounds really bad, because if you only watched the film or heard about it, you'll think I'm saying that because of the social commentary. What actually made me feel quite literally physically uncomfortable was the gender politics and ideologies present in the book. I'm going to give this quite an in-depth review, just because it's really necessary for what I want to say about the adaptation, just because there's so much to this book, if that makes sense. It's very complex. As I said before, I understood immediately why this was a classic. D.H. Lawrence observed his time and decided to write it with none of the concealed metaphors of his predecessors and contemporary authors, as well as, you know, many authors that followed him. And yet, this book isn't a lecture. Sure, we're told who is absurd and to be ridiculed, but also we're told that with evidence and meaning behind it. And, you know, caricatures are such a common fixture in literature nowadays, and, you know, were back then. And here we get these rather wonderful, in-depth presentations of the mindset of a variety of groups of his day, with that being the original and very intentional purpose of the caricature. And these mindsets are embodied in these characters and conveyed through the dialogue, specifically these long, winding, monologue-esque ones. And while the rich and those who continue to desire their approval are mocked and subjugated to Lawrence's critique, the working class is persistently pitied, their conditions constantly highlighted. It's important to note, of course, that this is a moment in which there's a lot of political unrest and upheaval, not only in Britain, but across Europe. These big superpowers such as Britain, such as France, including Germany as well, they've witnessed Russia become a communist nation. They've watched a massive empire, a massive kingdom collapse, a kingdom that's been around for centuries, and they don't know what to think of this new political regime. We're watching this is the end of the Industrial Revolution. The Industrial Revolution of the 19th century is now dying out. You've got the Front Populaire, which is an alliance of the left in France. It's about to rise to power in the 30s after the Great Depression, and they're going to improve a lot of workers' conditions. They're going to fix holidays, they're going to fix the work week, to protect workers' rights. The Beveridge Report in England in the UK is going to come out in 1942, which is going to revolutionise workers' rights as well, and then will lead to Labour's landslide victory after the war. You know, this is there's a lot of change about to come to Europe. Like, this is, and I think Lawrence does a great job at portraying the unrest that is already there before everything becomes so much worse with the Great Depression. And that's why I think it's, you know, quite fantastic. And that's part of its appeal. However, whilst I understand why it's a classic, it's certainly not timeless. It's very rooted in its time, and it's flashes of racism, anti-Semitism, and misogyny, and, you know, classism as well, but that's not so bad because it's a topic of the book. You kind of leave a bitter taste for those of you who enjoy its surprising awareness and understanding of its time. And it's not, oftentimes it's not even there for effect, you know. It's, so that was the problem, especially when it came to the racism and anti-Semitism. I admit that calling it a classic, then saying it's not timeless, seems a bit contradictory, but I don't care. It became too much for me at times. There's also this weird underlying pity for men, despite there being many moments in Connie, so Lady Chatterley's internal dialogue, where I was genuinely rather impressed by this rather progressive and frustrated female voice. And then we have these very almost self-indulgent moments with each male character, where they whine about women or discuss their role or just act really selfish when it comes to their needs vis-a-vis women. I don't know for sure if these passages are mocking or sincere, but they appear amongst every character that becomes an important part of the book, and even some of the characters that don't. And the truth is that it feels too prevalent for its appearance to come across as entirely satire, in my opinion. And Mellor's, so the lover, he's not the opposite. He doesn't not do this. He's bad in a whole other way when it comes to this. And the thing is that because it's constantly there, because this pity is constantly there, it becomes almost validating. And it seems to validate male criticism of what women fail to give them. So by trying to balance itself between the controversial criticisms of men and their attitudes towards women made by Connie, and then the norm and male perspective, Lawrence favours the norm. To rest essentially neutral in these two views is to reassure those who wish to maintain the status quo, and to allow them to continue blindly believing in their own correct vision of society, even though there is that other point of view. And I just want to say, obviously this is not why this is a bad book. This isn't explaining why I don't like it. I just wish I think I would have rather he chose a side. And technically he is being somewhat revolutionary, I think is a bit of a strong word, but revolutionary by even including this female point of view, I guess. He does this on the fence thing with class two, actually, through his third person perspective and through Connie, who both pities and defends the working class against Clifford's indifference towards them, and yet she continues to refer to them as half men, going as far as to pick apart even Mellor's behaviour, her lover's behaviour. And I think the key tone of this book, when it came to Connie and Clifford talking about people of lower social standing from them, really was pity. It doesn't help that Connie has this ever critical attitude towards literally everyone, which dilutes the effect of her commentary. She's also presented as having this almost hysterical and weak disposition, which further invalidates her as a true speaker. Eventually, now I'm talking about the book. Now I'm talking more about the book rather than my opinions. But the book eventually kind of overdeveloped itself, and made the key points that make the beginning of the book so poignant completely redundant and forgotten by the reader. And I think the book was scandalous in all the wrong ways. Part of the reason why I was really enjoying the first part of the novel was because it not only had some very well executed social commentary, both through Connie and dialogue, but also because multiple times I stopped to question, you know, was this book really written by a man? But oh boy, did it become evident. It has, in that first part of the book, it has this certain sense of universality. You kind of sense the possibility for this book to be appealing, or at least interesting, to a really wide audience. And then it sort of eats itself up. And if I hadn't known this was supposed to be a romance, or was seen as a romance, there's no way I would have seen it that way. Reading about her and her lover became very quickly, by the way, a like actually dreadful experience. There were so many brilliant moments in this book, but goodness, did I want to give up. There was too many times I wanted to give up. It didn't compensate. Okay? It didn't compensate at all. The film was more palatable. It was thinned down, to be more correct, to make it easier for us to watch. Mella's and Connie's romance is much more gratifying for its audience to observe, because it's a rather positive thing. It still does well, the film does well to transmit much of what Lady Chatterley is described as in Lady Chatterley's lovers in the book, is described as, aka a taboo romance that transcends class and mocks the arrogance of the rich vis-a-vis their own sense of superiority. So this is like, if somebody who didn't know what Lady Chatterley's lover was and had just kind of heard about it, I think that's the best definition they'd give. And, you know, in a loose sense, that's what it's about. In a very loose sense. I was able to stomach the film a lot better, though, you know, through the lack of gender politics in comparison to the book. However, that's where it fumbles as an adaptation. I thought the casting was brilliant, the score was wonderfully used to highlight moments of tension, and the way it was adapted was impressive. But obviously I'll go into that more later. If I were to say anything on the film alone, just from a viewer's perspective, I did not like what was going on with the colour of the film. I say colour because instead of the lighting choices, because I feel like that would be embellishing what seemed to be going on. I hate criticizing stuff that isn't, you know, whether it's a good adaptation or not, but this was really jarring. It felt like someone whacked a greenish grey filter onto the whole thing and then went, right, all you have to do is record the bits with Lady Chatterley's lover, aka Connie and her lover. You have to record all of those parts outside when it's sunny, and that's it. Like, I feel bad for saying that, genuinely, but at first I was like, oh, this is really clever, like, it's really miserable and stuff, and then it didn't change at all. So, yeah, sorry. As I said before, I'm biased. This whole thing is awfully biased, because I didn't like the film, and I admit that. This wasn't my cup of tea. I was somehow hoping the film would be different, which is not to say it's a bad film. I just think, for me, it's just not something I enjoyed. Thing is, I hate sex being overused as a portrayal of romance or to show a relationship, and I really disliked having to watch it play out and watch the sex scenes, despite all the other elements and, you know, the fundamental premise of the film being something I really liked. As a romance film, as purely a love story, I think this film is actually quite lost in its genre. Its most remarkable trait being the text it was based off of, and again, the sex, but not entirely in a positive way. And there was some great acting. Emma Corrin did a fantastic job, as well as Jack O'Connell, but I didn't like it. If you like classics, if you like a challenge, if you want something that will keep you thinking long after consuming it, even if you think about it because you hated it, read the book. It's one of the most explicit and overt pieces of social commentary you'll read in a classic. It's also worth reading if you have any particular views on what gender relations should look like, aka everyone, because it quite literally attempts to not side with a particular view. Do not read this book if you're expecting it to be a before its time book on women's sexual liberation. That's not what's going on here, and if you interpret it that way, I don't know what to tell you. I have some questions. If you want a period romance with sex in it, as most period romances don't have sex in them unless they're actually written nowadays, and you want a film that also gives you a good indication of the sentiments and state of society at the time in between the two wars and some great one-liners about capitalism, then watch the film. I don't have a definite answer to the question which one is better for this one, but I can say that this was a good book to film adaptation. There was a great use of dialogue and the ending was carried out fabulously. Anyone who's read the book will pick up on how well the structure was conserved, but also modified without detriment to the tale, sometimes even enhancing it to ensure that context and as much of the book as possible could be found in the film. One of the hardest things that this film had to do was fit in all the context given by her internal dialogue, because she's talking to herself a lot, okay? They did a great job. That was fantastic. I was very impressed. They added a wedding scene at the beginning of the film that was not in the book. As I was saying, they did do some alterations to the structure at the beginning and the end. They added a wedding scene at the beginning of the film that was not in the book and is obviously set before the main events of the book during the war, which is when they got married. And it was really well used and well placed indeed. They used it to show how rushed the whole marriage was. We get the idea of Connie being a bit of a romantic, which she is in the book. And then, bam, straight off the bat, we get the importance of an heir, very much emphasized in the wedding scene. It's there. We know that having an heir is important. It's in our minds now. And this also heavily affects how we perceive her lover, you know, Mellors and Connie, Lady Chatterley, his relationship, because you could perceive it as her having an affair, but that's not what happens, really, because she's given permission. So yeah, really, really, really well done. I really appreciated it. It also set up the dynamics between her sister and her, and we get from the beginning pages that of the book that they're very close. So it was nice to have an introduction, and we could tell that her older sister was very caring, she was someone who looked out for her, who wanted what was best for her. Yeah, it was really well done. And then slightly further along, they use letters, the reading out of letters sent, to unlock part of Connie's internal monologue, and that as well was perfect. It seems like a cheap way of having internal monologue, but they are similarly used in the books as well. As in the books, they don't just say, oh, she wrote a letter, but rather like we are privy to Connie's mental state and events through complete letters, which are part of the book. So the fact that they use them in the film was completely fair. I thought it was very well done. They weren't overused. Great, fantastic. We do lack her indifference towards men and her thoughts on intellectuals, but because these elements, obviously they affect themes, but they don't affect the plot. They don't, them not being there doesn't have, yeah, it doesn't matter so much. So it's not so jarring. So overall, I think they did a great job at getting around the fact that obviously books offer a lot of insight onto characters' mental state because of the internal monologues they have. Now we go on to the themes, because they are what make this book. This book is rife with opinions and commentary. So let's start with the first one, which was the social commentary surrounding class. It was well done. I have to say, I think there was, I saw a couple, every single time I do these episodes, I end up seeing, you know, like the little, no, I don't know, it's not a resume, but like, you know, when you're searching and you've got the title of the article and then you've got like a little, or not a description, but like the beginning of an article. And every single time I do one of these adaption episodes or I'm doing any research for these things, I'll always end up seeing some of those, whether I want to or not. And a lot of them were saying, not a lot of them, the two that I saw both said that they had a problem with the lack of social commentary in this film. But I think that that might be being a bit too harsh. It's tough. You know, D.H. Lawrence has these very long winding dialogues in his book, which are simply just too long to include in full in a film. But they're also, these dialogues are incredibly good at delivering a critique on society and on certain behaviours and certain attitudes. And these dialogues, I think, are fantastic, if not a little tedious at times. And then in the book, you also have these very important scenes in which social commentary is explicitly expressed through characters. And to be honest, I was consistently impressed at how well they, you know, maintained the structure of the film and the way they adapted it to fit into the film. Sorry, going a little bit off topic, but for example, the end of the novel lacks direction and has no concrete conclusion to Lady Chatterley's tale, but the film removes all the waffle and gives it a proper finish in accordance to the tone of the film. Maybe not in accordance to the tone of the book, but in accordance to the film. And yeah, I was a little in awe at how well it was conducted. It was really good and it fit really well into their vision. So I have no complaints with the ending. I think they did a good job at serving social commentary and like translating the social commentary present in the book into the film. As I mentioned, there are two primary ways that social commentary was delivered in the book, through key scenes and through long dialogues delivered by a range of characters. The great thing about classics is exactly what I said last week during the, well, it's not last week, it's how long ago now? 3 weeks ago. 3 weeks ago, during the Dracula episode, which is that classics have an insane amount of nothing going on for effect, but films can compensate for this with tone and lighting and setting. So the film was able to cut that out. And so the key scenes were, they therefore maintained and remained authentic to their original symbolism and meaning, both through a replication of actions and by synthesizing the main topic of each conversation into, you know, a few lines, again, whilst also keeping the structure. Because there isn't enough time for everyone to have their turn at displaying their point of view when it comes to classics, when it comes to adapting classics in the way that it's done in the book. But somehow, every character that made it into the film did get their moment, if that makes sense. There's a moment in the book where Mellors goes on one of his biggest monologues about class right before they go dancing in the rain. And in the film, up until this point, Mellors hasn't directly addressed class yet, which he would have done in the book. But yeah, so class has never been addressed as a central topic to discussion, and it isn't discussed by him, not really, again in the film. So he's got a maximum of 2 minutes to get out his class comment, his point of view on this discussion about the dynamics between different social classes, and he's got to do it in a manner that doesn't cause a rupture in the film. And they drop this fantastic line, which is, "You've got to cut them parts of you that feel off. If you're going to send men into mines or factories or into battle, it's either that or you live with what you've done." Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. As I said, amazing, amazing work going on when we're talking about the dialogue. Fantastic. Loved it. Was very, very impressed. So then with the other characters, specifically Mrs. Bolton and Mrs. Flint, they were able to remove kind of the fluff around what they have to say, which obviously feeds into their fed into their characterization in the book. But honestly, it's not very necessary for them. Their nature isn't incredibly influential to the plot. Besides, maybe a bit Mrs. Bolton, but yeah. They kept the fundamental function of these characters and their actions, and they really stuck to the book as accurately as possible. It really was well done, and they definitely kept the plot smooth sailing. And because there wasn't all that fluff, that enabled them to kind of have the time to transmit to their audience the lives that they were living, and therefore their point of view on society and the point of view that they offer on society and the struggles the working class was facing at that time. You know, so for example, Mrs. Bolton explains how she only received £300 for her husband's death, and how the value of her husband's life and death came down to how he died, and how kind of cruel it was that they were able to put a value on his life. Mrs. Flynn also highlights the inability for miners to properly protest due to the threat of losing their jobs. There are two elements that were excluded, not done, that could have been what made this a near-perfect adaptation. And they are the inclusion of Michaelis and a better use of the passing of time. Michaelis is a self-made playwright from Dublin who had a lot of success in America. Connie has quite a long-lasting affair with him, in which he asks her to marry him and leave Clifford, but whilst he offers her attention and a certain degree of physical affection, she recognises that he is just like other men, although more desperate for society's approval, and she kind of loses interest in him. Here in the context of social commentary, Michaelis is different because he rose to fame through his own skill. He's self-made, which means he wishes to be accepted by the other members of the upper class. It's not in the film, but one of the points D.H. Lawrence makes is that even among the rich and wealthy, there are different types, as in a prejudice among the elite's members. And this distinction between different types of rich people isn't just made between Michaelis and her and Clifford, but also between her, but also between, you know, Lady Chatterley and Clifford, although not to the same extent. He is referenced in the film as being one of the men that Connie could have taken for a lover to make a child, but in the film, as soon as Clifford sees Michaelis paying attention to her, he has him removed from their lives. Also, I'm sorry if I'm pronouncing that wrong. It's spelled Michael and then IS at the end. So I was like, is it Michaelis? Michaelis? So yeah, I'm sorry. And then the second element was time. Time. They're supposed to have been in Rugby for several years before the main events of the book. This means they're supposed to have spent several years with Clifford hiding away from his duties as owner of the mines, which we are informed are failing whilst there are strikes going on as well, meaning people are not getting paid enough, people are discontent, and Clifford is writing books and literally explicitly says he can't do his job. So someone else is running the whole thing for him. Considering adding a whole extra character and plotline would have taken a considerable amount of time, I think that really emphasizing the passing of time, I think it would have been the easier thing to do instead of adding Michaelis. Like, sure, Michaelis shows a great nuance in the film's understanding of the book's themes, but I think that having one point from the book fully developed is better than having two lines underdeveloped. Now for Connie's different relationships with men in her life, aka the gender politics in this book, that aren't in this film. I wrote this all way before International Women's Day, by the way, even though I was doing a lot of editing of the script on International Women's Day. This has barely been edited. I was bang on the first time I wrote it, which is quite funny to me. So yeah, so this, but this could have been, this can't be any worse, basically. I can't be more annoyed about the gender politics in this book, the lack of it in the film, because even Tilly on International Women's Day was happy with this. So yeah. Okay. The biggest issue I had with this film was that it did not commit, it did not seem to properly acknowledge the second big topic of the book, which is the gender politics and ideologies present in the book. Okay? Just so you know, gender ideologies refers to attitudes and opinions regarding the appropriate roles, rights, and responsibilities of women and men in society. Specifically here, it's about only women. And then gender politics is a term that's used a lot and has very many, like, lots of different meanings. But here, it's about the discourse and debate surrounding those ideologies and what's considered the right one. Okay, so we need to get this straight, first off. This book was not a romance, okay? You can kid yourself and not include any of the deliciously painful gender politics and gender ideologies present in this book, but it's not a romance. Can we please stop it? It was a damning representation of the misery of being a woman at that time. The two options were guy who doesn't appreciate you, commodifies you, but still wants you around, and guy who loves having sex with you, listens to you sometimes besides during sex, and degrades you horrendously, and literally said I love you because of the sex you give me and the fact you're actually into it. And that's it. He didn't really say I love you properly at any point that I remember. Okay? As I said in the intro, things become a little convoluted when it comes to the presentation of gender dynamics and what D.H. Lawrence's opinion is on the matter. But if there's one clear common factor in all the men in this book, is that they expect things from women and they expect them to fit into their lives in a certain manner. Obviously, a great part of this is subjective, but I'm pulling these points from the text and what occurs. Either way, the lack of gender commentary was just crazy, and I think, unfortunately, the film ended up zoning onto the very singular point when it comes to gender relations, which is that, like, sex isn't just sex, and its unfolding is a good metaphor, a good demonstration of the way men perceive women. But the fact that was kind of the only point that was in the film is rather reductionist and is an unjust injustice to the much more complex ideas behind this book. I'm gonna introduce book Connie first. I don't think Connie in the book is meant to be likable. She has no allegiances whatsoever. She's both the devil's advocate and the voice of reason. Like, sure, she's in a society that exploits everyone, but she's picky with her advocacy. In her moments where she stands up to Clifford for his class's views, it isn't a clean-cut opposition to those views like it is in the film. She internally teeters between pity and disgust when it comes to the miners, calling them half-men. She's pretty derogatory towards her lover as well. She makes many interesting pieces of commentary on men, and she ends up with a man who is just as derogatory towards women, although in a different manner, as her previous lovers, with the sole exception that I think this is a good way of putting it, is the fact that she holds power over him. She's the one with the money. To say he adores her or dotes on her would be a complete falsehood, as in Mellors. He gives her a lot more, like, not a lot more, sorry. He gives her more than her previous men, for sure. But we're talking about some very ambiguous bare minimum here. And I think that By failing to commit to her character and her gender commentary, the full potential of the class commentary is lost, and a kind of exploration of the different forms of privilege. Furthermore, her relationship with Mellors wasn't scandalous because it broke any particular sexual norms, but rather, at least for me, obviously I'm a modern audience, but to me, the only reason why it was scandalous is because it was derogatory and degrading on a very, on like a different, more intimate level, of course, but still. And thing is that he simply had a different manner of seeking his own pleasure. I had to stop reading it for a couple of days as well. Like, it was just, it was awful, guys. It was terrible. The first note I wrote at the very top of my page, like when I started this, was this is going to be really hard because there's a lot to be said in the sex. So, but I am going to try and keep the sex talk minimal. There's a lot of talk about the importance of sex in a relationship. And Clifford says that it isn't. Mellors says that it is. And we find that in the book. We find that in the film. And I think that's, you know, a very interesting point. And I'm glad that it was in the film. Mellors very clearly qualifies sex as being integral to relationships. And he says that's part of why his relationship would fall apart, because there wasn't an equal commitment, participation and pleasure among him and his partners. But the thing is, the sex in the books is just another way of showing how men wish to take from women. All of the men still require women to do it properly for them. Mellors makes all this effort because it brings him pleasure. That's why, okay, I really don't want to talk about this, but that's why it shocked me in the film when Mellors actually does foreplay, like actual foreplay, instead of just fondling her, as like in the book. He does just kind of do his own thing in the book. But yeah, so the foreplay kind of implies a much more selfless level of, I want you to enjoy this, that just isn't there in the book. And I mentioned how Michaelis, Connie's first lover, would have been a good inclusion in this film because he brings something to both central themes of the book. And one of the ways he feeds into gender politics is by saying that he hates when he gets herself off after him. He said it annoys him and hurts his ego. I think this film does a decent job when it comes to how they handle the sex scenes, in the sense that it does show that for these men, sex is, at least for Clifford, sex is for him, and it's about him taking pleasure, with, you know, like Clifford refusing to pleasure Connie after he becomes paralyzed from the waist down. I don't know, they did a decent job, but again, as I said, that's not like the only point. So yeah, in the book, Michaelis works very well in tandem with the use of the passing in time to highlight the commodification of women as well. That's like his main use, I think. And I think that's one of the key things that the book highlights when it comes to the dynamics between men and women. And you just don't see that enough in the film, how women are often commodified to serve and in favour of men. It wouldn't even be far-stretched to say that this book points out how much unpaid labour women do. Michaelis proposes to Connie. However, when he does it, he essentially says, I need a wife, and who would be better to fill that role than you? As in, there's a big emphasis on the fact that she'd somehow be completing a hole in his image and filling in a role by his side. We don't really get a full idea of Connie's commodification by Clifford in the film, because we don't get a great idea of how time is passing. However, in the book, she's supposed to have spent several years doing everything he needs, with her whole life and routine essentially revolving around him, with no respite and no real friend, and he does nothing for her. Obviously, she's his caretaker, he's paralyzed, and he also refuses to allow anyone else to complete other roles. She's doing everything for him. She literally has been neglected as a wife and as a human being. There's no end to her servitude to him either. She doesn't get to go home at the end of the day or on the weekends. You know, she's working on his same projects with him. She's his typewriter. She edits him. She corrects his work, and where we could have had this fantastic portrayal of how marriage can be for women and how it's perceived by men, at least in the 1920s, in the film we get the impression that Clifford and Connie's marriage is just like a loveless marriage that's died out through routine and a lack of maintenance and passion. But it's supposed to have, we're supposed to have seen this mind-numbing, miserable life, which is Connie's life as the neglected housewife. And we don't get that. And I think that's such a shame. And when people talk about how you can allow yourself to be degraded and mistreated by men as long as you consent, I think of Connie and Mellors. That sounds really bad, but there was nothing liberating or feminist about their dynamic, only that she chose to be in it and enjoys it. His treatment of her was, you know, still a genuine reflection on how he sees women. He even goes on this massive monologue on how he perceives women, and it's really not that much different from what the other characters think. Like, he's really not great, and the book was not a romance for me at all. And by the end of the book, the dynamics between Connie and Mellors felt as though Connie liked that he was actually intelligent and semi-decent, competent in bed, and Mellors liked the sex and the company, kind of, and he liked the fact that Connie was so into him because she was attention deprived. So when things started gaining momentum towards the end, you know, it literally felt as though he was just going along with Connie because he has little else to do, and she and her infatuation with him makes a nice change from his previous partners. Personally, I wanted her to free herself and be happy of her own volition, which is why I honestly should have stopped around the page, like at the one third mark, like 120, page 120. That's where I think you should stop, to be honest. You know, Connie at the beginning objects to the idea of giving herself away and conforming to what men wish to. I think she basically describes it as what men wish to take from her. That's not my words. And she presents the argument that men are almost like children. But, you know, what's so upsetting about this book is that she does. She gives everything to them in the end. She fulfills this role that she's been mocking the entire time. She falls for it. She gives all she has to a man. And that's fair enough. But, oh, it feels cruel. It feels wrong. And whenever there's a passage with Connie's father, her mother is evoked, and it's always in a derogatory manner. And every single time I think of this quote by Bonnie Bestow in Radical Feminist Therapy, Working in the Context of Violence, that I'm sure quite a lot of you know this quote, which is that often father and daughter look down on mother, woman, together. They exchange meaningful glances when she misses a point. They agree that she is not bright as they are and cannot reason as they do. This collusion does not save the daughter from the mother's fate. That's what it feels like. That's what it feels like every single time they talk about this poor woman. Now, I couldn't tell for sure if it would be accurate to imply that this is what happens to Connie. It kind of feels that way, though. Either way, I hated how they spoke of her mother. So as you can see, there is a lot going on when it comes to gender politics, and it is there are so many different points of views, and it's very interesting. So whichever point of view you agree with and whichever point of view you support, it should have been in that film. It should have been in that film. Like, I don't know, I feel uncomfortable. I feel uncomfortable thinking about this book. I feel uncomfortable describing, and I haven't even described like all of the elements that in this book. I've kind of even essentially given you like a surface level description, but you know, all this to say, I just, do you feel how rich this book was in gender commentary? Like, do you sense how different this film could have become, could have felt? I don't know. It's a missed opportunity. All things considered, they translated the structure of the book into the film very nicely and worked around the difficulties of adapting such a detailed and intricate book. Where they modified the ending, I think, was brilliant. As I said before, I was very impressed. They used the side characters very well, to great effect, but you can't skip out a whole theme. And I don't think the core of this story is the romance. So, yeah. Which leads into what I would have done if... what I would have altered, I think, more than what I would have done if I redid this. I think I would have just altered it. I think they did a pretty good job anyways. I want Lady Chatterley's Lover to be done almost as a horror movie on society's condition in the period between both wars. I want it to be as grim as it felt to read it. I want Connie's relationships with all these men she sleeps with to appear as awful as they were. She was simply an accessory to these men's lives. They held on to her because she fulfilled a need, a role for them. I want her to seem as pathetic as she comes off as. But I want her internal voice to hold as a testament to the slow bending of her will to men, because that's what it felt like, her slowly conforming to what she was meant to be in society's eyes. Connie should have remained the ambiguous character she is, you know, torn between modernity, progressiveness, and then traditional values and capitalist views. I want more absurd intellectuals and the unrest in England. This is what I would have done if I were to kind of redo the ending. I think it would have been great if she'd... this is... okay, obviously this is straying away from the book. This would be completely reimagining the end. With Connie choosing to stay with Clifford after deciding that her class prejudices were too strong. And, you know, with Clifford refusing to divorce her. And then we'd have Connie kind of continuing to live miserably, regretting her decision not to run away, and then either, you know, giving birth and I think suffering from postpartum depression or even dying in childbirth but not being satisfied with the way that her life has ended up. I think that would be a good way to conclude. I don't think she should be I don't think she should be happy by the end of it with all of the gender politics. Not because I want her to be unhappy, but because I don't think it would fit into the tone. I mean, which is why I also understand why the end of the book doesn't end. It ends with Mellors and her being apart, trying to come up with a solution as to what to do. So I do understand the ending of the book, even though it's incomplete. And then meanwhile, I think, well, Mellors would have been fired either way. And then I think it would have been good if he was... became like a kind of testimony to the consequences of this society that they all live in. Like, he either got crippled or killed due to a mass industrial accident, or even like died in World War II, but yeah, or killed in an industrial accident caused by neglect of safety conditions, with him being reduced to being yet another victim. I think it would have worked as a wonderful conclusion. Correctly served the wonderful beginning of this novel. And that's obviously that last one of those last suggestions, being that Mellors died in World War II, obviously strays away from the bounds of this book, because it D.H. Lawrence didn't know about World War II. But I think that's a possible ending that would have served the beginning of this novel very well, and would have made for an interesting adaptation and a change from previous adaptations as well. So yeah, I hope you enjoyed that. I'm glad I got that book and that film out of the way. I think they're both very interesting, and I would recommend them. But I wish adaptations would do something more interesting, because obviously I'm talking about... so far, I've only really talked about adaptations in the sense that of, in the lens of how well they actually replicate the book. But I think there's much more that you can do with them. And I think this is one of those texts where it has been adapted multiple times, but they could have done something different and then still made something really good out of it. I've decided that I'm going to kind of... today, I don't really have a question. Usually I have a question for the end of my podcasts, but I thought I would also try and introduce me talking about one of the highlights of my week, or the highlight of my guest's week when it comes to the ones that I do with another person. But the highlight of my week
this week was going to watch my little brother do his role in Matilda, the musical, at his school. So he is in front of me right now. So yeah. Frankie, did you enjoy being part of Matilda, the musical, which is your first musical that you've ever done?
I really did, because it's just a pleasure, because, well, the musical can be really hard because you have to rush to the to your classroom to get your costumes, and then you have to immediately get changed. Sometimes you get quick changes, and you just have to get changed, and your scenes, and you get news from, like, your scene being only one scene away, then you just start rushing. I was seen 4 times, at least. First one for Miracle, I do My Daddy Says I'm a Special Little Guy. I also do When I Grow Up, and I do the the drums for the Chokey chant.
Mm-hmm.
I do When I Grow Up, I do Quiet, and then I do the Bulgarian Mafia.
And which role would you have played if you could have played any of the roles?
Bruce
Bogtrotter.
Yeah.
And are you excited to do another one?
Very. If it would be one of the books I've read, generally, that would be very fun, because at least I would actually want. Because next year I'm going to be in year 6, so I'm going to get one of the main roles. And if I don't know if this is going to happen, but if we do Magnus Chase, I will be the happiest boy in my life, in the world.
It was so good, and we did lots of whooping and cheering. I went with my sister as well, so we were cheering very loudly. I think parents need to whoop louder for their children, because we would have thought that Frankie was the main character out of, like, all of the kids, because of how loudly we were cheering. But yeah, I really enjoyed seeing you do your performance. You did some wonderful singing.
Thank you.
Proud of you. On that note, next week I'll be joined by a special guest to talk about their favourite book or film or television series. I don't know what that is yet, so that'll be really exciting. All the podcast social media will be in the link in the description. Close, go close. And you say it softly. No, not that close. Like here, and go. You go. Have a nice day. I hope you enjoyed.
Have a nice day. Hope you enjoyed. Bye.
Bye.
Don't know why.